Welcome, everyone. This is Beverly Tomasian. We're really excited for our second session in the Diabetes Fundamentals. Today, we'll be talking about exercise and nutrition, and you can download the handouts for this webcast from our Fundamentals resource page. We sent you a link in the email, or also after this session, we'll send you a link where you can download the information and get access to a bunch of resources. I've really put a lot of great resources on that page to kind of supplement what we talk about today, because this is a big topic, nutrition and exercise. And we're going to try and cover key points in the hour and a half. And, you know, we could spend a whole day on this topic. But the goal of this program is to give you, you know, the essentials of what you need to know moving forward in diabetes education, and also to provide you with the latest research, because there's a lot of exciting research in this area. So without any further ado, let's take a look at what we're going to see. Talk about today. We're going to look at nutrition guidelines, describe current medical nutrition therapy recommendations. These were just released in 2013 late and then republished in 2014. So those are the most current recommendations we have right now. And throughout these recommendations, of course, there's a person living with diabetes. How do we help them make healthy choices and still have a positive relationship with food? That's a big strategy, because a lot of people with diabetes, as you know, think their life is over because they're not going to be able to eat what they love to eat. So how can we maintain the pleasure of eating and still encourage them to make those healthy choices? We'll also talk about exercise guidelines. What are the goals for people with diabetes? And, you know, there's particular safety precautions for people living with diabetes that we need to share with them. So we're going to talk about that also today. But before we get started, I'm going to launch a poll so to learn about you all. And we'll just take a few minutes on this. What is your profession? And as I always say in each of these, I only have five spaces, so I have to be creative in the way I cluster professions together. So if you're not on this list, I apologize, but you can always send me a note later what your profession is. Thanks, you guys. You voted. And we actually have a really nice representation, 25% nurses, 50% dietitians, and 25% pharmacists. Excellent. As you know, it takes a team to manage diabetes, and I'm so glad there's dietitians joining us today. And certainly, as I go through this program, as a nurse and a certified diabetes educator, I'm going to be presenting just the basic foundation of nutrition therapy and the latest findings, but always referring our patients with diabetes to a registered dietitian is a critical part of what we do. They have so much expertise in food, nutrition therapy, and helping people integrate life and food together in a realistic way. We'll talk more about how truly amazing dietitians are and lowering blood sugars. And so I just want to say thank you to dietitians. I've had the honor and privilege of team teaching many years with dietitians, and I learned so much from my colleagues. So let's keep going. Let me see. I have some resources for you. There's the ADA Standards of Care, which look at nutrition therapy recommendations, what I was referring to. That's on your resource page. And also I put a link to the exercise and type 2 statement put out by the American Diabetes Association and College of Sports Medicine. They have a joint statement outlining goals for exercise, precautions, and so forth. So those are really some great resources to take a look at to expand your knowledge. So a lot of our patients might feel like this when they step on that scale. You know, my trying to lose weight, the weight's not coming down, the scale seems to go the wrong way all the time, and it's very frustrating. And so by the time they come in to see us, a lot of our patients are discouraged. They've tried many weight loss strategies. Maybe they've been successful, but they've regained the weight. And so many times they present to us in this feeling of despair, a feeling of failure, and a feeling of what do I eat and what can I eat? So this is a nice time to give them a message of hope and to say the diabetes diet is a healthy eating diet. It's not even a diet. It's a meal plan. It's just a way of eating healthy for your life. And as we talk about this, you'll see they get more relaxed and they start realizing that even if you don't have diabetes, we're just making good, healthy food recommendations, which I think really allows them not to feel different or deprived in any way. And as we approach each patient, we want to keep in mind that each of our patients are unique. And I love this quote by Oscar Wilde, "Be yourself. Everybody else is already taken." What a great image to portray that each of our patients coming in comes with their own history of eating, their cultural preferences, when they like to eat, breakfast. Maybe they don't eat breakfast. They eat twice a day. They eat three times a day. Maybe they have some issues with food. So as we sit down with the person across from us, we're going to really help discover what's going on with their relationship with food. And many times we're going to do a food recall and see what they eat during the day. And really important is the timing of when they eat. So many of my patients, I work with an older retired population, their first meal of the day is 10 a.m. And so how do we work the diabetes into their lifestyle? When I first meet with people, I'm generally just going to say, let's figure out what you're doing now and see if we can work the diabetes in. And over time, we might make some bigger changes, like instead of eating two meals a day, do you think you could eat three meals a day? But I do want to say that behavior change is really big for a lot of people. So I go very slowly on that one. And then just talking about individuals, each of us as healthcare providers and health professionals and educators has our own particular style of presentation and our beliefs. So we bring that to the table too. And so we're kind of integrating our perspectives and beliefs and the science of nutrition therapy, and we incorporate that with the patient. How are they living with their diabetes? What is their situation? Can they afford food? Are they just struggling to get enough to eat? So we're going to blend all of this together as we move forward in supporting their efforts to make changes. As you know, we can't make anybody do anything. It's totally up to the person. So I just want to ask you another question. For someone with newly diagnosed diabetes, what would be some goals that we would strive for? And you can choose more than one here. For someone newly diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, what would be some appropriate goals? Thanks for voting, everybody. I appreciate it. And, during this webcast, there's no wrong answers. We're just learning. We're just learning together because things are changing. And what I used to say when I was first in diabetes education is a lot different than what we say now. And I've been in this for 20 years. So thank goodness things have changed. It's a lot more humanistic what we recommend to patients right now. Okay. Thank you, everyone. I really appreciate it. So you guys are on fire this morning already. I appreciate it. Well, some of you might be later in the day. But nobody chose A, avoid all desserts and processed food, because that avoiding all desserts is not realistic. So if we said limit desserts and processed foods or eat less of it, that would be the right answer. But we can't tell people never eat any of these foods again. We're going to coach them on how to integrate them into their meal plan in a way that's healthy for them and realistic in their life. Now, B, nobody chose that. Try to lose 5 to 10% of current body weight. And I'm going to talk about this more, but the research is showing that with someone with newly diagnosed type 2 diabetes, losing weight early on makes a huge difference. And so the research is supporting that we want to help patients lose weight early on in their diagnosis of type 2 diabetes to preserve beta cell function. C, eat less than 7% saturated fat. I want to tell you that was the old guideline. I'll just share this with you so you can all see. We used to say eat less than 7% saturated fat, but the American Diabetes Association and the Dietetic Association said we're going to match what we recommend for all people, and that's less than 10%. So that was a change. You guys got eat breakfast right. That is a big goal. The United Nations and the World Diabetes Day Foundation campaign is like try and get breakfast in it. It helps with weight management, and also it's a great way to start your day. And you guys got E right. Yes, avoid sugary beverages. So great job, everybody. Let's keep going because we're going to talk about this more as we go through. So the medical nutrition therapy recommendations for 2014, the most recent one, I didn't, they were okay for me as a practitioner, but I wish sometimes we would get a little bit more direction, because here's what they said. No ideal percentage of calories from protein, carbohydrate, and fat for people with diabetes. So it's really totally individualized. Macronutrient distribution should be based on individual assessment of eating patterns, preferences, and metabolic goals. So I do appreciate that they're saying start with the individual, see how they're eating, and make some changes based on their food patterns and ways of eating, but they don't give us anything that's black and white. And so, you know, it just takes us time to be able to learn and assess what is best for that particular patient. But that's where I think the dietitian is so critical, because they have so much training and experience and expertise in this area, figuring out macronutrient distribution and what's the best meal plan based on this patient's not only clinical presentation, but their food preferences. So medical nutrition therapy from the ADA, look at this. I love these so much. Focus on individual. Maintain pleasure of eating. So many times my patients say, I don't want to get diabetes. You're going to take all my favorite food away. Positive messages about food. I love this. Limit food choices only when backed by science. I am old enough to remember the days where we would give patients a tear-off sheet with all the foods they could not eat. That was our nutrition information to get them started. You know, that wasn't even backed by science. That's just saying you can't eat sugar, you have diabetes. So now we know that you can integrate sugar into your meal plan. Provide practical tools. Absolutely. Let's find out what this patient, how they manage their life, and provide tools that match their style. Look at this. I was talking about the awesomeness of registered dietitians. You refer a patient with type 1 to a registered dietitian, they can help lower their A1C 1%. Type 2s, they can help lower their A1C 2%. That's based on science. That's based on fact. So the dietitian provides a therapeutic intervention as effective as medication. And I want to tell you something else that's really making me nuts right now. Only 10% of patients with diabetes are referred to a dietitian. 10%. 10%. That number should be 100%. Only 10% of patients are referred to diabetes self-management education training. 10%. So we need to really reach out to our providers and to our communities to say, we're here. We help. We help lower A1Cs. We help prevent complications. We want to be of service to you and your patients. And actually, in my community right now, we're doing a lot of direct marketing to patients, and that's really improving our referral rate, because we tell the patients, we're here to help you. We know diabetes is hard. We know making these changes are difficult. We want to coach and support your efforts. And so we get the referrals from the patients, and then we contact the provider. Well, we get the inquiry from the patient, and then we contact the provider for a referral, and the provider never says no. If the patient is interested, providers go for it. So we're just trying to figure out ways to get more people living with diabetes to benefit from these services. As far as Medicare, they do cover medical nutrition therapy, 3 hours initial benefit in the first calendar year. You can see a dietitian for 3 hours if you have Medicare. Wow, what a gift. In a year, 2 hours follow-up annually. Now, they must be recognized by ADA or AADE, and dietitians can provide medical nutrition therapy for diabetes in patients with kidney problems. So this is a benefit we want to make sure our patients take advantage of. So the approach to how we approach food depends on the patient. And I do want to say, with new type 2s, big deal. This is all from the ADA recommendations, portion control, plate method, record keeping, education. But if they're on insulin, we're going to look at all of those, but add on carb counting and looking at postprandial blood sugars. So for our new type 2s who are not on insulin, who are on oral meds, portion control is a big deal and really helping people to move towards some weight loss if possible. But if they're on insulin, we're going to do more intensive intervention. Now, I just thought I would share with you the sodium, fat, and fiber recommendations. The sodium recommendations are the same as the general public for people with diabetes. Try to keep it less than 2,300 milligrams a day. And most of that salt is not coming from the salt shaker on our table. It's coming from processed and fast foods. So anything that comes in a window, through a window, in a package, you know, canned, really high chance of having a lot of salt and sodium. So this is kind of where we would intervene with patients is, say, looking at how much processed food you're eating and moving more toward fresh fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and so forth. Vitamin and mineral supplements, not recommended. I have so many patients who are on limited budgets buying these, you know, vitamins and all these different herbal remedies, but we don't have any good science to say that these work. I'd rather them spend that money on healthier food. Fat. What about fat? Wow, a lot of controversy about fat. We'll talk about that more, but same as recommended for general population. Less than 10% of their fat intake from saturated fat. Limit trans fat, and this has been around for a long time, less than 300 milligrams of cholesterol daily. And based on some science and evidence, a Mediterranean diet looks like a good option in helping people with weight management and their laboratory, you know, their clinical measurements such as their lipids and blood pressure and so forth. Fiber, wow, 25 to 38 grams a day. That's a lot of fiber. Most Americans are barely getting half of that. So again, we'll talk about this more, but how do we encourage people to get fiber? But let's kick it off with the soda slide. I call this my soda slide, sugar slide. The average American consumes 25 teaspoons of sugar a day. That's shocking. Kids are consuming 12 teaspoons of sugar a day. And so we really want to take a look at this. One soda has 12 teaspoons of sugar, and on average, one person consumes 40 gallons of soda each year. And I don't know if you've heard about this, but they did some research on sodas that show that drinking a soda a day increases your risk of getting diabetes 26%, 1 to 2 sodas a day, and drinking 1 to 2 sodas a day decreases the life expectancy by about 4 years. So there's some really good research coming out supporting that sodas should be avoided, basically. And even the American Diabetes Association said limit sodas and beverages with high fructose corn syrup and sugar. And so that's definitely a message we can give with confidence to our patients. American Diabetes Association, again, eat less junk food and sugary drinks. This is in their clinical guidelines. And they were saying that sugary beverages seem to increase that visceral adiposity if they have sugar or high fructose corn syrup, either way. And then there's Mayor Bloomberg trying to, you know, help New York get healthier. He wants to ban soft drinks larger than 16 ounces. There's this huge public outcry. And then you can see this little cartoon where the guy gets 2 12-ounces to, you know, get around that. But actually in Mexico, they put a soda tax on recently for the past year. And soda consumption went down 10%, and the consumption of milk and water went up. Isn't that terrific? And in Berkeley, California, recently they passed a soda tax. So I know everybody here listening to me has a different view on soda and taxing and public health and all of that. But I think just like cigarettes, if we decrease consumption of sodas, we'll improve the health of our nation. And if that means imposing a tax to help people get healthier, I support that personally. I support that. Okay, teaching about healthy eating. So how do we, like a patient with type 2, they come in to see us, they're on oral medications, and they just need some getting started strategies. And we talked earlier about, you know, portion control is a big deal. So I'm just going to present some different strategies to teach about healthy eating. And based on the patient and your comfort level, you're going to use, you know, one or more of these. So the first thing I generally bring up to my clients is move toward the tomato. It's a very simple concept, but it just gets a dialogue started. And that is, you want to move away from the Twinkies and the Ho-Hos and the processed foods and the, you know, fast food, and move toward whole grains, fresh fruits and vegetables, nuts. And these foods from the earth is how I describe it ultimately. Because they are the most nutritious, and they have phytonutrients and all kinds of ingredients that support health. I even have a cup of coffee here. So many patients say, I can't drink coffee, I have diabetes. I'm like, hey, there's some studies that show drinking coffee 1 to 2 cups a day can actually help prevent diabetes. So there's nothing wrong with coffee. It's just all the stuff we put in it that becomes a problem. I put in here a BMI chart just to kind of look at the relationship between normal weight, overweight, obese, and extreme obesity. And I'll actually put a link to this on our resource page. But every time a patient comes in, I get an idea. I look at their body weight and their height to determine where are they in their BMI? And if their BMI is 25 or greater, I understand this to mean they have insulin resistance. So the BMI gives us information about where they are relative, you know, to their height. What is their body weight relative to their height? And it also tells us maybe they're storing extra visceral fat, which is increasing their blood sugars, contributing to that. It just gives us a baseline. So here's what I was talking about earlier in that slide. Losing 2 to 8 kilograms early in diagnosis of type 2 helpful. So that's about 5 to 18 pounds right around there if you times it times 2.2. And so getting back to that original question, losing 5 to 10% of body weight. So if I weigh 200 pounds, 5% of that is 10 pounds. So definitely that weight loss seems to really help preserve beta cell function. And I want to personally tell you, I've kind of had a conversion because when I used to meet with people with type 2 diabetes, I would really focus on healthy eating. But now I'm really, if they're willing and interested, focusing on how do we achieve some weight loss, if that's a goal they want to work on. And, you know, 95% of my people with type 2 diabetes want to lose weight. So here's some other information. The optimal macronutrient intake to lose weight is not known, and there's no literature that supports one way or another for weight loss. So we just have to try different approaches. And one common question I'll ask my patients is, have you lost weight in the past? And they'll say, yes. I go, tell me what worked. And then many times we can you know, bring that back to life, give that CPR, because if that's worked for them in the past, there's a chance it will work for them in the future. So people with diabetes, just like people without diabetes, need ongoing coaching to lose weight and to keep that weight off. And losing weight isn't easy. You all know this. To lose 1 pound, you have to avoid 3,500 calories. So let's just think about what that means in real life. Let's just say a sandwich is about 500 calories. You have to eat 7 less sandwiches to lose 1 pound. That's why weight loss is so hard. And so we want to acknowledge that, that losing weight is hard, but every pound matters. Here's another strategy. Decrease intake of calories by 500 calories a day, and that will equal 1 pound a week. And if you combine it with exercise, exercise doesn't cause weight loss per se, but it helps people keep weight off. So to lose weight, eat less. That's the bottom line, not easy to do. And according to the American Diabetes Association, here's some successful weight loss strategies. Weighing yourself once a week, not every day. Eating breakfast. Eat less fast food. Decrease portion size. We all know this. Get active. Use meal replacements. So meal replacements mean like every day for breakfast you have an energy drink, or, you know, not, I don't really want to say that word energy drink, but what I meant to say is a healthy drink replacement, like maybe, for example, a Glucerna. So I'm not a big proponent of Glucerna or these drinks, but sometimes they do, studies have shown they help people lose weight. That instead of eating lunch, they have one of those, you know, calorie controlled beverages, and that way they can make sure at that particular meal they eat less, and that might help support weight loss. So I apologize for saying energy drinks. I do not believe in energy drinks in any way. I meant to say drinks that replace calories instead of eating food, but they're calorie controlled. And so this, you know, again, gets to our personal philosophies. How do we feel about that? But another example would be Jenny Craig. So Jenny Craig gives you meal replacements where you get a standard set of, you know, calories in a bowl or a plate, and that helps people to not overeat. Eat healthy foods. That's pretty obvious. Okay, bariatric surgery. So in the American Diabetes Association, in their standards, do say that for adults with a BMI of 35 or greater, so this is morbidly obese with diabetes, we should consider bariatric surgery. And interestingly enough, bariatric surgery early in diagnosis of diabetes has better outcomes because you have more beta cell mass. So the earlier we do it, the better outcomes as far as lowering blood sugar. And you can see it's bariatric surgery is more likely to cause remission. 68% have remission within 5 years. and 35% redeveloped diabetes. So let me talk about this, what this information means. That remission means blood glucose at normal level without medication. So bariatric surgery does not cure diabetes. It doesn't make it go away. You still have the genes for diabetes, but what bariatric surgery can cause is remission. That means your blood sugars are normal without medication. That's the definition of remission. So at a 5 year, 70% or 68% of people still had normal blood sugars after bariatric surgery. But the other 35% redeveloped diabetes after 5 years. So after bariatric surgery, if that person is in remission, but yet they gain weight, their blood sugars can go up. This is the long-term benefits are still under investigation, but I just want to let you know it is there in the standards of care. And of course, anybody with bariatric surgery needs lifelong support and monitoring. And I'll just say one more thing about this, that after bariatric surgery, you'll notice that their blood sugars come down even before they've lost weight. And it's not because of weight loss, obviously, because they haven't lost weight. It's because bariatric surgery increases the availability of gut hormones, those GLPs that we're going to be talking about in the medication section. So when you increase the gut hormone levels, the GLP-1 and the GIP, we see the blood sugars come down dramatically. So there's a lot more research going on behind the scenes regarding that. Okay, here's myplate.gov, another strategy to help our patients eat healthfully. I love what it says. Enjoy your food, eat less, don't oversize. Make half your plate fruits and vegetables. At least half of your grains are whole grains, so that's a quarter of the plate. And switch to fat-free or low-fat milk. Look at reducing sodium intake and drink water instead of sugary drinks. So that's one plate method. I just Googled different plate methods and I like this one a little bit better. I like the visuals. I like what's on the plate. And I really like, this is in Spanish, but that they say, get a plate of 9 inches. The average American now is eating food off a 12-inch plate. So our plates got bigger. As our plates got bigger, our portion size got bigger. And actually, there's this guy in Japan who invented glasses that would actually magnify your food to make it look better so we feel more full. Well, instead of getting the magnifier for your food, just use a smaller plate. It has the same outcome. And so you can see here, 1/4 of the plate is starch, 1/4 is protein. And I love that half of this is vegetables. And look at the colors there. We have the green and the white and the red. And so the more colors, the better. And then over here, you have this fruit on the side, the beautiful orange. And my most favorite part of this is this glass of beautiful water. Now, we can make this water a little more sexy by throwing in some mint or a cucumber or a strawberry or a raspberry. And then I call it spa water. So we want to glamorize water because water is so good for us. And actually, man has been relying on water for a long time. I had a patient ask me, he goes, is water a beverage? I'm like, yes, it actually is a beverage. Okay, let's just take a look and see how nutrients affect blood sugar. And so patients, I just want to let you all know, don't really understand many times what foods are carbohydrates, what foods are protein, and what food is fat. And so we want to help them differentiate between these macronutrients. And knowing that carbohydrates are the food group that affects blood sugar the most, within 15 minutes after eating, we're going to see a blood sugar spike, and then it comes back down after about an hour or so. So you'll notice when we tell patients to check their blood sugar, we say check 1 to 2 hours after a meal. It's based on this. We want to see what their post-meal blood sugar is when the blood sugar should be moving toward a more stable state. Protein, interestingly enough, protein foods, raise the blood sugar very little. And actually, there's some studies that show protein stimulates the pancreas to make insulin. And so protein, really might help with blood sugar stabilization. And my patients, when I'm describing protein food, I'll say, well, any food that had a mother is a protein food. Actually, any food that had a mother also has saturated fat. So, you know, what are foods that had a mother? You know what I'm talking about, meat, chicken, dairy products, and so forth. So let's look at fat. Fat, again, fat provides satiation. As you know, people feel full after they eat it, and it doesn't really affect blood sugar. And so it's really the carbohydrates that do, but that doesn't mean that carbohydrates are bad. We need carbohydrates. They're our body's main source of fuel. So let me ask you all another question. Which of the following servings equals, you know, approximately one serving or 15 grams of carbohydrate? And you can choose more than one answer. All right. Thanks for voting, everybody. I appreciate it. The dietitians have this one in the bag. All right. You guys are, my polls are way too easy today. You're getting them all right. Okay, I'm going to work on making them a little bit harder for next week. This is my target. Thanks for voting, everybody. I'm going to share this with you. So nobody chose a small bagel. You're right on. Bagels are up to 60 grams of carbohydrate or four servings. But it is true that 1 1/4 cup of strawberries is one serving of carbohydrate or starch. So enjoy, you know, I'm always looking at providing and encouraging patients to eat foods that you can eat at larger volume. You feel more satisfied. A cup of milk is 12 grams of carbohydrate, so we consider it one serving or 15 grams. Nobody chose a half a cup of rice. You're right. It's 1/3 cup of rice is one serving of carbohydrate. And 1/2 cup of Jell-O is also one serving of carbohydrate. So if you are 15 grams, if you work in a hospital setting, you'll notice even for people with diabetes, we serve Jell-O after the meal, and that is because it has energy in it and it has 15 grams of carbohydrate. And a lot of times after surgery, people are underfed. So 15 grams was, you guys got those right. Great job. But let's just go over this a little bit more. And I just want to kind of give you some ideas of serving size and also recommendations. So carbohydrate needs for most adults, and so now I'm totally contradicting myself because I just said the ADA, you know, says there's no specific guideline for the amount of macronutrients for each person. But I feel that sometimes patients want some guidance or guidelines, and so this is a general goal that we might be able to share with patients, that each meal, 45 to 60 grams of carbohydrate, which is 3 to 4 servings. And this is, you know, not written in stone. It just gives us a frame of reference. What if we have, you know, a larger patient who's a man? You know, we go up to 75, even more grams of carbohydrate. But this is just for the general person. And then there's snacks in between meals, 15 to 30 grams. So generally, I say if you're going to snack in between meals, try and just make it one serving of carbohydrate, especially if they're trying to lose weight. The RDA says we should consume at least 130 grams of carbohydrate a day, which equals about 45 grams per meal. And so that's just another kind of guidepost that gives us information. But carbs do affect post-meal blood sugar. So if blood sugars are on the rise, then we're going to look at how much carbohydrate they ate at that particular meal. But I think this is a really instructive slide that looks at what is, you know, one serving of carbohydrate. And some of the ones that are really shocking to our patients include 1/3 cup of cooked pasta. They go raw, no, cooked. So 1 cup of spaghetti is 3 servings, and that's your 45 grams. That's not very much spaghetti. Okay, 1/3 cup of rice. So a cup of rice is 3 servings. Small tortilla, but look, there's a potato on here. So many patients say, I can't have potatoes anymore. I have diabetes. But a small potato is okay. It has fiber. It has nutrients. It comes from the earth. It's okay. And here's one of my favorite, cooked beans, 1/2 cup. And so beans are one of the superfoods that I really want my patients to move toward because of their fiber, their nutrition, and they're so inexpensive. So many times you've heard, you know, people say, well, healthy food is expensive. Actually, healthy food can be affordable. You just have to shop smart for it and get foods that are in season and go to farmer's market and learn how to cook. That's the thing that's really difficult for a lot of our people. They don't know how to make healthier foods because we're not cooking as much at home. And so helping them learn how to cook healthy foods with recipes or cooking classes is such a big help. Okay, fruit. I had another patient come in just the other day. This is like in the year 2014. My doctor said, I can't eat fruit. I have diabetes. I know you all are nodding your head that you've heard that too. That is the worst recommendation because, as you know, fruit has fiber, micronutrients, and it's just so delicious. How can you live not eating fruit? It's so wonderful. But just looking at the portion size, so generally I'll say to patients, well, I have 3 servings of fruit, but just spread it throughout the day. And don't eat a huge amount all at once. You know, just stuff like that. Keep it simple. Half a cup of fruit juice is 15 grams versus a small piece of fruit. So always encouraging people to chew their food instead of drink it. Chew instead of drink. You feel more satisfied and it takes longer. Milk. So many patients don't know that milk has lactose or milk sugar and it will raise your blood sugar. So we want to talk about that. And that includes soy milk has carbohydrates, yogurt. And then if they get the regular Safeway yogurt that has all that corn syrup stuff and fruit in it, that can be 45 to 60 grams of carbohydrate. So try and get the plain yogurt and add the fruit yourself, or you can get the light yogurt. And then the sweets. You all know about the sweets. So, you know, I talk a lot about ice cream because ice cream seems to be a universal favorite. People love ice cream and they think diabetes means no ice cream. And so we talk about getting the, you know, you don't have to get the sugar-free ice creams. Just get the low-fat ice cream or the churned ice creams. You'll see them in the store. The sugar-free ones, they still have lactose, milk sugar, and so they still will raise your blood sugar. And, you know, the findings on artificial sweeteners are controversial, so I'm really kind of steering my patients away from those if possible. But anyways, get a small bowl when you're dishing out that ice cream. Don't get a huge, giant bowl and put one scoop. Get a small custard dish and put one scoop. You feel more satisfied. Look, you can get 2 small cookies, 15 grams. So these are foods you can incorporate into your meal plan. It's not going to be the basis of your meal plan, of course. But every so often, you need a cookie. It's just part of life. So when we're going to choose carbs, we want to choose healthy ones. If we're going to eat foods that raise our blood sugar, let's choose foods that have fiber, vitamins, mineral, and phytonutrients. So here's some power carbs: beans, veggies, fruits, whole grain foods. And I love this image of this face with all those delicious vegetables and fruits incorporated. And I do want to say, and every time I meet with a patient and we're talking about food, I printed out this list of 10 superfoods and I give it to every patient. And it's like a gift. I don't know why. I give it to them, and they're like, I can eat all of these? I'm like, yes, these are great for you. And these came from the American Diabetes Association website, 10 foods full of fiber and phytonutrients that we recommend for people with diabetes. And, of course, you know, if patients are on a budget, I'll just say get the ones that are in season. But look at sweet potatoes. That beautiful orange color, you know, just full of nutrients for our patients. And I always say sweet potatoes are like the ultimate fast food. You can pop it in the microwave, you know, heat it up, put a little butter or salt or whatever you want to do to glam it up, and enjoy it. Tomatoes, fish high in omega-3 fatty acids, whole grains, nuts. A lot of information lately about nuts. You know, they cause satiation. They have fiber. The only thing about nuts that I caution patients about is it's not a bag of nuts, it's a handful of nuts. So the nuts are calorie dense. We just wanted to kind of talk about portion control. Fat-free milk and yogurt. Yogurt has some research is coming out on yogurt that it seems to have real nutritional benefits from the bacteria in the yogurt. And so encouraging our patients to enjoy these foods. Enjoy these foods. They're not expensive. And most patients, you know, can afford these, and really they're beneficial for your health. The other thing we talk about a lot in our classes and when we meet patients individually is that food label. There is legislation to update the food label to make it much more easily read and realistic as far as serving size. Of course, it's stuck somewhere in legislation right now, and of course, the food industry doesn't want it to go through, but hopefully we'll see something next year. But this is what we have to live with currently. It looks at serving size and servings per container, so that's an important piece of information. And then I do look at calories and total calories from fat. Generally speaking, we want the fat calories to be less than 30% of total calories. So this is 90 calories. If it said 45 calories from fat, I know that's 50%. It's way too high. So we'll look also at saturated fat. So we're trying to limit saturated fat less than 10%, avoid trans fat, looking at the cholesterol and the sodium. But really important for blood sugars is looking at total carbohydrate. And as you know, many patients get stuck on this sugar part. They're saying, well, I look at the sugar. Well, sugar is important, but it's a subset of total carbohydrate. And so you just want to see how many servings of carb per serving. And if you look at added sugar, when they add sugar, 1 teaspoon of sugar is 4 grams. So some of this sugar is just naturally occurring sugar in the food, and some of it is added sugar. So it looks at both of those. But just you'll see sometimes the sugar level is really high because they're adding sugar to the yogurt. So in addition to the lactose sugar, there's also regular table sugar going in there. But the main important number is that 13 grams. Now looking at fiber, if the dietary fiber is less than 3, it's kind of a low fiber food. So get the foods that have 3 or more grams of fiber per serving. That's the best choices. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about dietary fat and cholesterol guidelines. So average distribution for people with diabetes. So PWB means person with diabetes. If I don't have enough room in my slide, I'll summarize it like that. But this is what people with diabetes are eating right now in America. It was a great study that I found that was 45% of calories are from carbs, 30 to 40% from fat, and about 16 to 18% from protein. So that's not too bad. I mean, if they're looking to lose weight and they're eating 40% from fat, if we decrease that, those fat intake, that can help with weight loss because fat is the most calorie dense of all the calories. It has 9 calories per gram. And so this is what people are doing, and these are the guidelines from the ADA. 10% of our fat calories, less than 10%, should be from saturated. Limit trans fat as much as possible and limit dietary cholesterol to 300 milligrams a day. So let's just talk a little bit about some of the healthier fat choices, the monounsaturated. And then here's the other group, the polyunsaturated, other good fat choices. And here's the saturated fats that we want to limit and keep less than 10%. And I often talk to my patients about fat as a condiment. So you want to use it sparingly. You don't want to load it on stuff. So a lot of people think, well, it's a healthy fat. I should eat a lot of it. Well, it still contains calories. So looking at portion size, especially for people trying to lose weight around fat, seems to be very effective, and I have a slide on this later. So looking at portion and type of fat seems to be really important. So the research are looking at trans fat are saying that there's a strong link between diet high in trans fat and heart disease. Trans fat actually lower HDL, increase LDL, may actually increase weight gain and abdominal fat and contribute to type 2 diabetes. So we want to look at labels and avoid foods that have the word hydrogenated or partially hydrogenated. And I just want to talk for a minute about Little Debbie. Little Debbie, you know, look how cute she is, and she's on all these different snacks. So she's on the Ho-Hos and the Twinkies and the roll-ups and all these different things. And she's so adorable. You're like, I want to buy these Little Debbie snacks. And actually, I had a patient who was buying a lot of Little Debbie snacks, and I said, you know, John, you've got to break up with Little Debbie. He's like, I love Little Debbie. I'm like, you've got to break up with her. She's no good for you. And it was just kind of funny, but it is true that these foods don't supply us with any nutritional value. They don't have fiber. They don't have nutrients. They're just calories that don't sustain us or feed us in any way. And so this patient came back to see me next week, and he goes, I broke up with Little Debbie, and I was really excited about that. And I know you've all have heard in the news this controversy stirring around about saturated fat. Should we eat saturated fat? You know, are we avoiding it and then eating other calories in its place and getting less healthy because of it? And I thought I'd introduce here some recent research from Dr. Massafarian. It appeared in The Lancet, and I just want to talk about the saturated fat debate. And of course, we're going to keep debating this for a long time because food is an evolving science and there's a lot of different forces that impact the research on food. So the food industry has its agenda. And us, the other group of us, healthcare professionals, we have our agenda. So these two often are battling it out, trying to figure out what is really the healthiest for our people. But I'll just read this real briefly. The odds of incident type 2 diabetes and lower in people who have high plasma level of odd chain saturated fatty acids that come from dairy fats. So as it turns out, if you look at the fatty acids, the odd number chains seem to be a little bit healthier for people. And that's found in the dairy fats and yogurts and so forth. But listen to this. In contrast, even chain saturated fat, such as those that come from consuming alcohol, soft drinks, look at that, soft drinks, or margarine, were associated with a greater likelihood of diabetes in this study published on August 6th. I'll post that in your resources. These fatty acids include palmitic acid, the most common saturated fat acid in the U.S. diet. Interesting. And the conclusion here from Dr. Masafarian is that there's growing evidence that dairy fat might reduce insulin resistance in type 2 diabetes, benefits that might be greatest for cheese and yogurt. Okay, so this is where we're at today. I'm going to read a study, you know, in a few months that might contradict that. But I do, as I've mentioned, I've seen lots of studies now coming out supporting the benefits of yogurt. And certainly we all know about staying away from soft drinks and margarine's been controversial for a while. Now, alcohol is interesting because we'll talk about that in a minute. Seems to be some benefit with red wines because of the resveratrol that might help reduce inflammation. So you can see there's a lot of information coming at us from different angles. And as you can imagine, our poor patients trying to sort this out, how confusing it is for them. Okay. So this comes from the Diabetes Prevention Program, and I was trained as a trainer in the Diabetes Prevention Program, and what this program is all about is if people have pre-diabetes, they come in to see us and to this program, and we help stop them from converting over to diabetes. And I was really taken by their strategy to help people lose weight because that's their number one strategy. When that patient walks into the diabetes prevention program, they know from the studies that losing 5 to 7% of body weight reduces their risk of diabetes. So they're like, boom, let's help these people lose weight. It's a straightforward up and up goal when that person walks into class. And they keep health diaries. They write down everything they eat. They track how much fat is in it. And they actually have great success. So I'm not sure why we don't grab onto this in the diabetes world as much, but I'll just keep talking about what they do. They look at your body weight, and then they look at fat grams and calorie goal. So it's just straightforward. Count up all the fats you eat per day. They don't even differentiate between saturated, poly, and mono. And the goal is to eat less than your grams assigned by your body weight. And they have great results. I just want to point that out. Okay, let's talk about protein. So protein, for people with diabetes and no diabetes kidney disease, there's evidence is inconclusive for how much protein. Therefore, goals should be individualized. You know, we kind of generally say about 20% of your meal, of your food comes from protein. And you'll see that people with diabetes, as I mentioned, naturally eat 16 to 18%. So I think that protein doesn't seem to be a big issue. I just put down the RDA recommendations. That's not backed up by the American Diabetes or Dietetic Association, but that's what is recommended in general based on body weight. I do want to say this, though. Protein seems to stimulate insulin response. I have a lot of patients who tell me, oh, when my blood sugar is low, I eat, you know, peanut butter, or I have a piece of turkey or something like that. That's not a good idea because it seems that protein actually causes the pancreas to make some insulin. So we want to make sure when people are treating lows that they treat it with carbohydrates. And look at this. This is new, and this is the ADA recommendations. For those with kidney failure, reducing the amount of dietary protein is not recommended. It doesn't improve outcomes. For years, we've been saying, oh, if you have kidney problems or kidney failure, or your creatinine's, you know, above 1.4, your GFR is below 60, let's back off on protein. Well, that doesn't seem to be based in good science. So for right now, we're not recommending that. So protein is also 4 calories per gram. Fat is 9. Carbohydrate is 4. So protein is has less calories than fat. And we want to really encourage people to choose lean protein and look at plant sources. I do want to say that there's a lot of good research on plant-based nutrition, plant-based eating, that it seems to decrease not only body weight but inflammation. And I do have a really nice link on the resource page on plant-based resources, and it has a ton of articles and recipes that you can use for plant-based eating and share with your patients. And actually, many of my patients who are struggling with weight, I ask them, would you be willing to, you know, eat a plant-based dinner once a week, twice a week? Because I know generally when they eat plant-based meals, they eat less calories and they're getting more nutrition, more nutritious food. Generally speaking, we have to coach them on what to eat. It doesn't mean you eat tortilla chips and salsa for dinner. Limit the high fat protein and look at the serving size. So, you know, a 3-ounce piece of meat is equal to the palm of the size of your hand or a deck of cards. Just watch how much meat you eat, because that meat is full of saturated fat. And saturated fat has a lot of calories, and maybe we want to avoid eating too much of it anyways. So along with meat, it's infused with that type of fat and it's calorie dense. So just kind of looking at portion sizes and really surrounding that meat with a lot of vegetables and other beautiful salad and fruit. I want to ask you another poll question. So hang on. I saw my next slide. So I'm going to launch a poll question. Which of the following is true about alcohol and diabetes? So you can choose more than one. All right. Thanks for voting, everybody. I appreciate it. I like this E. Some of you are choosing the answer E here. Hey, it's Friday night, so now I know why you're all choosing the answer E. I know it's happening. Well, it's not Friday night yet. It's getting closer. Okay, take a few more seconds. Ooh, this is a good poll question. I'm going to keep this one. All right. I'm going to go ahead and close. Thanks, everybody, for voting. And share. Okay, interestingly enough, white wine increases blood sugars. A lot of my patients think that drinking wine will increase their, white wine in particular is sweet, so it will increase their blood sugar. That is not true. Wine, alcohol, causes low blood sugar. So whether the wine is white or red or sparkling or whatever, it will cause low blood sugar. Now, it is so that is not true, the first one. B, each day men can have 2 drinks and women can have 1 drink of alcohol. That is true. You guys got that right. And C, alcohol increases the risk of hypoglycemia. Yes, that is true. Okay, D, if you're going to drink, eat a starch. That is true. So when I talk to people, I'm saying if you're going to have alcohol, you need to associate it with a carbohydrate source, because alcohol can cause low blood sugar. So for every drink, you need a serving of starch to prevent lows. And this is especially true for people who are very physically active, young people, people at risk for hypo, people with type 1 diabetes. If you're going to drink, you got to eat. That's my line. And then E, a shot of tequila is better than a margarita. That is also true. Why is that? Because a margarita has so much sugar and calories. So the alcohol from the margarita might lower the blood sugars, and later they might get hyperglycemia from all that sugar and calories. So it's just better to have that shot of hard liquor. I'm kind of joking, but I'm really not at the same time. So here's using alcohol safely. Women, 1 or fewer alcoholic drinks a day. Men, less than 2 or less drinks a day. And here's the serving size, 12 ounces of beer, 5 ounces of wine, or 1.5 ounces of distilled liquor. If drink, limit the amount and drink with food, as I've mentioned. And alcohol, well, the reason why does alcohol cause low blood sugar? Well, there's one theory that is the liver is busy metabolizing the alcohol so we can't release the glycogen stores, so the blood sugar goes down too low. But I read a recent article that said actually alcohol stimulates the pancreas to make insulin, and that's what causes low blood sugar. But regardless, alcohol and low blood sugar do go together, so we need to be cautious. Let's take a look at Ms. Gonzalez. Ms. Gonzalez for breakfast eats 5 corn tortillas, a half a cup of beans, salsa, peppers, and egg beaters. And so we know she has 5 servings of starch here, another serving of starch with her beans, so that's 6. Salsa is just tomatoes and jalapenos and whatever. That's healthy for you. It's terrific. It's free. Peppers are free, and egg beaters are a protein. So let's take a look now at her before lunch blood sugars. So we can definitely see her before lunch blood sugars are going higher than target. The target for before the next meal is 70 to 130. She's 200s. So let's count up how many servings of tortillas of carbohydrates she has at breakfast. Well, 5 corn tortillas is 5 plus a half a cup of beans is 6. So 6 servings. And if we remember the slide, we said, well, 3 to 4 servings of starch per meal. So we know that's kind of a guideline, but we can also look at her before lunch blood sugars and see they're really above target. So we can have a conversation with Ms. Gonzalez, and we're not going to do the following and say, Ms. Gonzalez, you can only have 3 tortillas for breakfast. You see, we're not going to come at her in that direction, because when people tell you what to do, I'm sure you guys got the feeling of pushing back when I said that. So how we would approach is to say, Ms. Gonzalez, I noticed that your blood sugars are above target. So again, I'm not going to use that word high. I don't say, oh my gosh, your blood sugars are so high at lunch, because then she's going to feel bad like she failed. So I'll just say, I noticed that your blood sugars are above target at lunch, and I'm looking at your breakfast, and just so you know, each of those corn tortillas is 1 serving of starch, and the beans are a serving of starch. And generally, our goal is around, 3 to 4 servings of starch per meal. Is there any way you would be willing to cut back on either the tortillas or the beans? What do you think we could do to improve this? Okay, so you just see what happened. I explained to her which of the foods are carbohydrates. I showed her the relationship between her carbohydrates and her blood sugars. And I asked her, what do you think? Because I don't think Ms. Gonzalez knows that she's eating more carbohydrates than she needs at that meal. That's just the way she's always eaten. That's what she eats for breakfast. It's the way she ate when she was a little girl. It's just her habit. It's her culture. It's her upbringing. And it's just the way it is for her. And so we're going to point this out very gently and respectfully and see what she says. And she may say, you know what? I can go down to 4 corn tortillas. And we're going to say, great job. That would be terrific. Let's see how that affects your blood sugar. So last week we talked about our last session, we talked about paired glucose testing to say, when you go down to 4, let's see what happens to your blood sugars before lunch. And that will give us some feedback if that worked or not. Okay, let's just take a look at another time in the day. A large bowl of soup. We don't know how many carbs is in that. We have to ask if it's vegetable or is it, barley soup or is it tortilla soup? What is it? A cup of rice, that's 3 servings. Barbecued meat is protein / fat. Cooked vegetables and a glass of wine. So she's, had a hard day. She has that glass of wine at night. Good for her. Okay, so I do want to say one thing about wine, though. If people are trying to lose weight, alcohol does carry calories with it. So one strategy to lose weight is to drink less alcohol. So that's another negotiation we can have with her. But anyways, her blood sugars at nighttime are around 180s, and that's actually our target, before bed less than 180. So you can see that at dinner she's making better choices. So I just want to kind of summarize Ms. Gonzalez. We can look at her in more detail on your own. But there's a lot of stuff she's doing right. She's eating 3 meals a day. She's getting fruits and vegetables. She's trying to eat low salt, egg beaters. So she's very heart health conscious. But she still needs a little coaching and love to make some changes in the way she eats to get her blood sugars to target. So I would be very excited to meet with her. She's keeping a food diary. She's documenting her blood sugars. And I would give her a lot of encouragement for everything she's doing right and make some small goals with her to make some changes in her carbohydrate intake to help improve her blood sugars. And so this, I have a lot of hope just looking at this because she's doing so many great things that are already setting her up for success. We just need to kind of look at portion and carbohydrate intake. Okay, I'm going to do another poll with you all. If someone with type 1 diabetes is underweight, what might be some contributing factors? All right. Thanks for voting, everybody. All right. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll and share it with you. So someone with type 1 diabetes, you know, they make no insulin whatsoever. What could cause them to be underweight? And you all did a great job here. Celiac disease is one thing we look for. Diabulimia, another thing, and gastroparesis. Yes, all of these. So let's talk about each of these individually now. And so as diabetes educators, we're going to be looking for comorbidities or other conditions associated with diabetes that may not have been detected by the providers. And as we get more comfortable in the field, we can expand our knowledge and really reach out to patients and help them get the best care possible. Because many times people with diabetes have undiagnosed comorbidities, other health problems that really need addressing, but celiac disease. Let's talk about that. So here's a picture of a healthy intestine. You can see there's little villi here, these little finger-like projections. Here's the crypts where the food is. So the villi move the food along in your intestine, and then the food particles enter the crypts and are absorbed into your intestine. But here is a diseased intestine. The villi are inflamed. There's no longer the crypts there. So the villi are inflamed. They're not able to move the food along as well. The food doesn't get absorbed. And this is in response to an immune reaction to gluten. Celiac disease is an autoimmune reaction to gluten, the protein often found in wheat and other foods. And so this exposure to the protein gluten causes inflammation of the villi and causes malabsorption. So people with celiac disease have a malabsorption syndrome. And their signs and symptoms are bloating, weight loss, fatty stools, diarrhea, they have anemia many times, muscle tenderness. If they're a kid or a young person, failure to thrive, they're not growing normally. And many times this is actually confused with gastroparesis. And so we know that 1 in 10 people with type 1 diabetes has celiac disease. We're going to be on the lookout for it. It can happen at any time in their life. I've had patients get it in their teen years, and I had a patient get it in his 60s, and I had one gal get it in her 80s. So any time during the span of their life with diabetes, they can express this celiac disease. And if we're suspicious of it, we can do a simple blood test. The transglutaminase is the one that we would use. And we can also look at these other antibodies. So we do a blood test measure to see if these autoantibodies are positive. And if they are, we refer them to a GI specialist for endoscopy and a biopsy of the small intestine to confirm diagnosis. But once somebody is diagnosed with celiac disease, their treatment is gluten-free for life. Not just for a week or a month, but for life. So this is really challenging. And for these people, we definitely want to make sure they see a dietitian to get intensive counseling. There's been a lot of legislation now for gluten-free package information so people with celiac disease can easily identify which foods are gluten-free and feel safe eating it. But we want to avoid wheat products, rye, barley. Some people say oats because where the oats are processed, they're often exposed to wheat. So there's some, if they're very sensitive, they may not also be able to eat the oats. So this is an associated autoimmune disorder. People with type 1 are more likely to get celiac disease, but also other autoimmune diseases I've listed here. And I talk about this a great deal in my other course called Critical Assessment of People with Diabetes. And we talk about all these other comorbidities associated with diabetes, type 1. So here's an example of gluten-containing foods, just a list of foods that people need to be aware of: marinades, imitation seafood, soup bases, thickeners, all these different foods that have gluten hidden within that people have to be so cautious about, because even a little exposure can stimulate the autoimmune process again and get those villi really swollen. Let's just do this together. It's a little poll question. John has gastroparesis. What is the best recommendation? Eat raw vegetables and limit fruit. Eat low-fiber small meals. Always take insulin after meals. Or avoid food containing wheat. So gastroparesis. My stomach is paralyzed. So stomach paralyzed. Why do people get gastroparesis? Well, high levels of blood sugar over time can cause denervation of the stomach. So the stomach doesn't get the impulse to move the food forward. It's those muscles are paralyzed. So the stomach stays in the gut. I didn't say that right. The food stays in the stomach and it doesn't move forward to the duodenum. So the patient doesn't get absorption for hours, you know, hours sometimes. And so the recommendation that's right here as far as intervention is eat low-fiber small meals. That is so counterintuitive to us because we're always saying eat fiber. But if they eat a high-fiber meal, it can really slow down the digestion. So many times we might even encourage our patients to eat more liquid type of food if they have very bad gastroparesis. One big sign that a person has gastroparesis is that they take their insulin and then they eat, but their blood sugars drop after, they keep dropping after meals. If you ever see that, that tells you that maybe that food isn't being absorbed and that patient has gastroparesis. So just be on the lookout for that. And for those patients who get postprandial hypoglycemia because the food's sticking in their stomach, what we do is we give the insulin after a meal to prevent that from happening. But the best treatment to get that stomach working again is getting blood sugars down. When you get blood sugars down, the stomach often improves in its functionality. There's other meds we could try like Reglan and erythromycin. There was a time where we were putting in pacers in the stomach, like a pacemaker for the heart to stimulate it to empty its content, but that didn't really have very good outcomes as far as I've heard. The other thing we're worried about with our, especially girls with type 1 diabetes, is diabulimia. And just like women and girls without diabetes, and boys too, it can happen to both sexes. They can have this situation where they just feel overweight, even though the scale says they're underweight. And so they get into this situation and where they give themselves less insulin than they need to lose weight. So suppose I'm supposed to take, you know, 4 units every meal and 10 units at night. Well, I just skip it and just maybe take half my night dose. Then my blood sugars start running really high and I can lose weight very quickly. This is not a knowledge deficit. These people know diabetes. They know nutrition. They know exercise. They know everything to get their weight down. They really need a mental health specialist and a team to help them. Very, very serious condition that can not only lead to being underweight, but all kinds of other kinds of diabetes complications. So just be on the lookout for this. And if we do see it, make sure we have resources to refer the patient to. Okay, well, that concludes our session on nutrition. Now I'd like to talk about exercise. So let me launch a poll on exercise. Which of the following is accurate exercise information for people with diabetes? And you can choose more than one. Thanks, everybody, for voting. I appreciate it. All right, 100% of you have voted. Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and share this with you. So the first one, exercise must be done daily for 30 minutes. That is actually not true. Because to say to somebody, everybody has to exercise for 30 minutes every day, then most people would fail at exercise. So the recommendations don't say that. They say try to exercise for 30 minutes on most days or at least 5 days a week. So this kind of comes up to our goal setting with patients. If we tell patients, you need to exercise every day for 30 minutes, most of our patients are not going to be able to achieve that. Even think of ourselves as super smart healthcare professionals. We're unlikely to achieve that. And so we really want to base our recommendations on science and what's realistic for our patients. Okay, B, must get stress test before starting activity. That is no longer true. We used to say before you start a walking program, you need to get a stress test, but then we were blocking people from exercising. So we're only going to ask people at high risk to get a stress test, those who've had a heart attack or a stroke or at risk for that. Those would be patients that might need to get a stress test. But if we're just asking them to walk 10 minutes a day, it's okay. They can do that, most people without that stress test. But always reminding them, if you have any chest pain or discomfort while exercise, please let your provider know. So B is no longer true. C, you guys, 80% of you chose that. Yes, it's right. Try not to miss more than 2 consecutive days. So if you go longer than that without exercising, then you lose the momentum of the benefits. And then, yes, you are right on D, incorporate resistance training. So let's get talking about this. And talk about the recommendations that we have. Kids, you all know this. We should encourage kids with type 1, type 2 diabetes, and kids without diabetes to do at least 60 minutes of physical activity a day. So twice what we recommend for adults. Get out there and move around. So for adults with diabetes, 150 minutes a week of moderate intensity aerobic physical activity, and walking covers that. Spread over at least 3 days a week. So I'll tell patients, if you can only exercise 3 times a week, do it every other day, because you want to maintain that. When you exercise, it helps open up your muscle cells for 24 to 48 hours. Exercise helps you burn up sugar and get your muscles more metabolically active for 1 to 2 days. So you want to keep that momentum going. In the absence of contraindications, and the contraindications would be eye disease and other problems, but type 2 should engage in resistance trainings. We'll talk about that in a minute. So some weightlifting or the rubber bands or something where they're increasing muscle mass. As I mentioned in the first presentation, muscles use 85% of consumed sugar. The more we can get our muscles metabolically active, the more sugar we burn. It's worth it. So here's some definitions. Physical activity is body movement, where you use more energy than when resting. Exercise is really planned activity. And sedentary behavior, pretty obvious, these two kids right here. So exercise, sedentary. and then here's progressive resistance exercise. Really, they're talking a lot about this in the literature, because lifting weights or doing resistant activities really does increase insulin sensitivity. Just do it twice a week. And that includes free weights, weight machines, or those bands, what I talked about, where, those bands where you open them up. That is resistance training. Each session should consist of at least 1 of 5 or more resistance exercises using large muscle groups. So if you have access to physical therapists or a gym nearby where they can encourage the patient and teach them how to do this, that's terrific. But I think as educators, we want to get familiar with resistance training too. Exercise benefits cannot be overstated. It improves blood sugars, as I mentioned, 24 to 48 hours, reduces cardiovascular risk, maintains weight loss. So it's not going to cause you to lose weight, but it will help maintain the weight loss you've achieved. Very important. And well-being, I want to say that it's one of the best antidepressants out there, exercise. And also exercise helps prevent against Alzheimer's and dementia. People with diabetes are at more risk for Alzheimer's and dementia. Getting physically active activates your brain. And so in all of my diabetes classes, whether I'm teaching healthcare professionals or people with diabetes, we get up and move. And as a matter of fact, if you're sitting right now, I'm going to stand up with you. Just stand up. Move your body. And really, we shouldn't be sitting for more than a half an hour at a time, because sitting really increases your visceral adiposity. Oh, look at this. It slows decline in mobility. A lot of my patients are older. Their balance is really lacking. So by getting up and moving, you maintain your core strength and your balance. I don't know, whatever you can do to get people to move. I teach them how to move sitting down. I teach them how to dance in their chair. I teach them how to do balancing exercises. I mean, even during my one-on-one assessments, I often will get people up and do exercises with them so I can look at their balance and their abilities and get them moving. You know, once people start moving, they're like, hey, this really feels good, and they want to do it more. Importance of exercise with diabetes. It's a vital component of prevention of diabetes as well as management. And you know what? It has a really great impact on improving metabolic abnormalities in type 2. So that when I say that, that's that whole insulin resistance. It really decreases insulin resistance and can help prevent the progression of pre-diabetes to diabetes. And for type 1 diabetes, it's very important also because it helps them regulate blood glucose levels. And many times people who are very athletic with type 1 cut their insulin doses in half. And so exercise is an important part of the diabetes management plan. As a matter of fact, I'll say, get up after dinner and take a walk. Taking that walk after dinner is like injecting 2 units of insulin. So I kind of try and quantify exercise in a way, like instead of increasing your insulin or your pills, let's do a walk after dinner and see if that doesn't lower your morning blood sugar. Again, that paired glucose testing. If you do this, what happens to your blood sugar? And that's a real motivator for patients too. So let's just talk about making sure our patients are safe before exercise. And that is using clinical judgment when making physical activity suggestions and making sure to check in with the provider. And so if you're not sure, you may want to ask the provider, is it okay if we recommend this type of exercise? If they're a high-risk patient, start with low intensity and short time, gradually increasing. And the contraindications, like this is a good list to take a look at, hypertension, neuropathy, foot lesions, unstable eye disease. And a patient with complications requires a more thorough assessment, obviously. Let me ask you one more poll question. What are some exercise precautions you would suggest for people exercising with diabetes? And you could choose more than one answer. Okay, we'll take a few more minutes, a few more seconds. Thank you, guys. I think you can choose more than one answer, right? I hope so. If not, just choose one answer. Whatever you choose is great. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this and share with you. So, yes, carry some form of identification with you at all times. Very important. Because I always tell my patients, what if you're walking and you get hit by a car? Well, I don't always tell them that, but I just want them to have identification in case something happens to them and they can't speak on their own behalf. What if they get low blood sugar? Make sure they have identification and who to call in case of emergency. Always have a snack if blood glucose less than 100. Okay, that is not true, because I only need to have a snack if my blood sugar is less than 100 if I'm on insulin or a medication called a sulfonylurea. If I'm just on metformin and I'm going to go exercise, I don't necessarily have to have a snack because metformin won't make my blood sugars go too low. Or if I'm on an SGLT2 inhibitor like Invokana. So you don't always have to eat. And the problem, I think, sometimes is that people eat more than they need, and then they all that work they did exercising, they overeat to compensate, and that they have trouble losing weight because of that. So C, so you don't always have to have a snack, only if you're on insulin or sulfonylureas. C, look for signs of hypo for up to 24 hours afterward. That's absolutely true. So exercise, suppose I'm shoveling snow or I'm mowing the lawn or I'm raking the leaves. That exercise can affect my blood sugars for 24 to 48 hours afterward. But particularly for kids and older people on insulin or sulfonylureas, if they do something very physical during the day, they're at higher risk for low blood sugar in the middle of the night. Be prepared for that. They might have to eat a little bit extra calories before they go to sleep, but always just kind of keep that in mind as we're talking to patients. Carry a snack with you during exercise? Yes, absolutely, always. Always have a snack. And I do like E, let someone know your route. I have a lot of older patients, they're out there walking and nobody knows where they are, where they're going. If they don't return, somebody needs to know what their route was. So I think, except for B, those were all good recommendations. And the other thing we want to tell our patients about is to discuss symptoms with provider before starting exercise. Of course, if they have chest pain, leg cramps, head, shoulder, neck, or back aches. If any patient with diabetes says, you know, I have some pain in between my shoulder blades or in my back, that's really unexplained, it just kind of comes out of the blue, we should really consider it cardiac in nature until proven otherwise. So make sure they get, you know, appropriate testing from their provider. Let's just talk a little bit about the hormone response when people with type 1 exercise. So a person with type 1 injects insulin, so even when they exercise, their pancreas can't regulate, self-regulate, so they have extra insulin floating around in their bloodstream, and this puts them at higher risk for low blood sugar because they take insulin, it's still in their bloodstream, it's not down-regulated, and so they're at risk for low because when you exercise, you have increased insulin use and increased insulin sensitivity. So more glucose is getting into your muscles and leaving your bloodstream. So we want to make sure for our type 1s that it's going to take some trial and error, but they'll figure out, oh, if my blood sugar is 100 before I exercise, I need to eat, you know, 15 grams of carbohydrate. Or if my blood sugar is high, I don't really need to eat extra carbohydrate. I can, you know, go with that for a half an hour. For our type 2s, their pancreas is still working, so they have decreased secretion of insulin during exercise. They are more insulin sensitive, and they do burn up more sugar. So our type 2s, they'll see blood sugars come down after exercise. I do want to say sometimes because of adrenaline, they might have a bump up initially in their glucose, but over time it will come back down. So if they're not on any insulin or a sulfonylurea, they're not at risk for low blood sugar. But if they are on those medications, they're going to need to take cautions too. So we know that in both situations, blood sugars can be affected for 24 to 48 hours after activity, especially of long duration. So we want to really precaution them against hypoglycemia. So hypoglycemia risk can happen during exercise, immediately after, or late onset. More often in type 1, we see this late onset, often at night. And it's really correlated with high intensity exercise of more than 30 minutes. So we're just going to keep an eye on that for, especially for our patients with type 1 diabetes and our older frail patients. So some hypoglycemia prevention strategies. If there's a planned activity, many times patients can take a little bit of their bolus insulin with that before that planned activity to accommodate for that activity. Some of our patients with type 1 might actually cut back on their basal insulin a little bit if they're doing a lot of training. So it depends on that particular person. But if for a lot of type 2s, they could just take a little bit less bolus insulin before they do their activity, knowing that that activity acts like insulin, 2 units worth approximately. That's just kind of my gauge. It's worth about 2 units of insulin for every half an hour. It's different for everybody, but that's kind of a good working model that I've used. So we want to monitor frequently after exercise and keep a log to see, when I do this, this is what happens to my blood sugar. So that paired glucose testing we've talked about. So you want to make sure they carry a fast-acting carb with them. And if they have type 1, they have access to a glucagon emergency kit or that glucose gel. They might need to eat extra carbohydrates post-exercise. And remember, alcohol can cause low blood sugar. So after you exercise, if you go out for a beer with the guys or with the girls, you're at higher risk for hypoglycemia. And so here's some, if patients are on insulin or on secretagogues, if their blood sugar is less than 100, the general rule of thumb is have a 15-gram carbohydrate snack. Now, if you look over here, this is not a 15-gram carbohydrate snack. I mean, this is the problem. When a lot of times when we exercise, we think, hey, I just worked out for half an hour. I can have, you know, a cookies and milk. But then your blood sugar might go up again. And it might not help your body weight either. So I just put a little chart in here. This is actually from Dana Armstrong on looking at the intensity, duration of exercise, and what would be the carbohydrate replacement. Again, this is for patients on insulin or sulfonylureas. Let's wrap up talking about behavior change goals and SMART goals. So let's say we have a patient come in to see us and she says, well, I currently walk my dog 3 times a week around the block. The first question I want to ask all of you is this exercise? And what new and revised SMART goal could you set with her? Before I talk about her, let's just do one more poll. Now, before I do that, I'll launch the poll. Okay, so which of the following is a SMART goal? And SMART goal means it's specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and timely. So it's something that you could actually measure. So there's only one right answer here. Which of the following is a SMART goal? Specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and timely. And this is a goal that you can measure to see if you have success. Okay, good job, you guys. Yes, okay. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll. Thanks for doing that. So, this first one, I will lose 5% of my body weight. It is a goal, but it doesn't have any time with it, or doesn't have any behavior change associated with it. So if a patient says to me, well, I want to lose 5% of my body weight, I'm like, well, how would you do that? And I go, well, I'll eat less. I go, well, can you give me something more specific? Well, okay, I can eat less chips. Okay, well, how often would you like to eat less chips? Well, I always eat chips every day at 2. So I think I'm not going to eat that bag of chips at 2 o'clock. Okay, so you're not going to eat the bags of chips at 2 o'clock. How long are you going to do that for? Well, let me try it for a week. You see what I mean? That's D. You guys, 50% of you chose that. So if it's vague, like I will monitor my blood sugar on a regular basis, it's not enough details. I would change that goal. I would say, well, what's a regular basis? Well, I could do it once a day. Okay. What time of day are you going to check your blood sugar? Well, I could do it once a day in the morning. How long do you think you'll be able to maintain that? Well, let me try it once a day in the morning for a month, and let's see how that goes. So that's getting to a SMART goal. And setting goals with patients that are SMART really help them to succeed. And then we can measure how are we doing. But I really want to say something critical about this. And that is we want to make sure that it's not too hard for the person to achieve, because if it's too hard and they fail, they feel really bad. So sometimes I'll have patients say, I'm going to exercise for 30 minutes every day. And I'm like, wow, that's 7 days a week. That's a perfect score. Maybe we could make it a little, you know, the goal a little bit less so that you can achieve it. And they might go, okay, well, what about 5 days a week? And I'm like, okay, well, how confident are you that you could do it 5 days a week? Well, pretty confident. So we keep negotiating. I'm like, well, what about 4 days a week? Are you confident there? Oh, yeah, I could do four. Easy. Okay. Let's say exercise 4 days a week. And if you do any more than that, that's bonus points. So we really want to help our people to succeed, because succeeding is such a great feeling. And it gives us momentum to keep trying. When we don't reach our goals, we feel like failures. And so here's that SMART goal I was mentioning: specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, timely. And here's some examples of behavioral goals. Walk the dog around Julie wants to increase her exercise activity. So what are some goals that we could, you know, do with her? Maybe she walks the dog around the block 4 times a week. Maybe she walks the dog around the block 2 times instead of 1 time. She's going to help us figure out what goal is realistic for her. Or maybe she does 10 minutes of weight-bearing activity on 2 of the days she doesn't walk the dog. So we're going to just do a lot of problem solving, questioning, I would call it exploration with her, to find out what's realistic for her and what does she want to work toward. And in conclusions, you know, many times we'll help set goals with patients and they'll be like, oh, I'm on a roll, I can do this. You know, they're really excited and they have a lot of energy. But patients do have setbacks. I've been in this business long enough, and I'm sure you've seen this too, where they're doing really well, they have got great momentum, they're moving forward, and then they just, I don't know, they're just like, they burn out, or they give up, or they just like, I can't do this, it's so hard. That's a very common human nature, and we want to help our patients know this. Many times when a patient's leaving my office, I will say, you know, we've written these goals together, and I want to let you know that if you're not able to achieve these goals, it's okay. You're not failing. We're just setting these goals out as a way to move forward. But even if you don't make these goals, I still want to work with you and see you. Come back. Let's talk about it. Because the greatest glory in living lies not in never falling, but in rising every time we fall. And that's what our people with diabetes need, that there's times when it gets really tough and they just can't keep going and they're feeling frustrated and discouraged. We reach out our hand of kindness and support and coaching and help them get back up again and help them move forward. So giving them permission not to do it perfect is a really important part of what we do as educators. So I want to thank you all so much for joining, for participating in the polls, and for being a part of this Diabetes Fundamentals course series. We'll be having another session next week, and we'll be posting more information on our resource page. And I'm going to close now, but after I close, I will stay and answer any questions. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. This is Beverly Tomasian signing off.